This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Mothers and daughters, brothers and sisters, old lovers, new lovers. Human relationships are rarely tidy and neat. And when they're in a story by Kalamazoo writer Bonnie Jo Campbell, you know they won't be neat, but they will be powerful, offbeat, sometimes shocking, and always interesting. That's certainly the case with her latest book, a collection of short stories called Mothers Tell Your Daughters. Bonnie Jo Campbell, it's such a pleasure to have you with us today on Stateside.
Oh, it's so great to be here.
Well, I can tell you, reading these 16 stories, Bonnie, you took me places I never expected to go. I flip a page, I'm on a circus train, flip some more pages, I'm on the home hospice bed in the farmhouse of a really fascinating woman, castrating a donkey, sitting in a hen house, bicycling through the mountains of Romania, and of course, right here in Michigan. What unites all these settings in this one collection, do you think?
Well, mostly they are Michigan. I pretty much always write about my own home state where I'm from and where I've lived most of my life. And I do rely very heavily on our landscapes. I always say that the way that writing works is that somehow you have these characters and that they do reflect off the places they are. And I did kind of have to prove myself that I could write about someplace other than Michigan by writing about the mountains of Romania.
And you did it so well. And then I go digging around and realize you have done this. You've biked through there.
Yes, that's right. The only reason I dared write about Romania is that I had actually bicycled this one stretch of the Romanian road about four times. So I knew it very well as I know some of my Michigan roads. So that gave me the confidence that I could head out to another country.
Well, Bonnie, every one of these characters is rough around the edges. And that's really the hallmark of your writing, your novels and short stories, that you get the feeling people have had, life kick them in the teeth, whether it's choices they've made or things that have been done to them. What draws you to these people?
Well, I'm really interested in how people deal with all kinds of adversity. And in this book, often the women are dealing with maybe the adversity of some kind of sexual violation, some kind of ill treatment. But I'm not interested in them as victims. I'm really interested in seeing what these characters are going to do next, how they're going to get through their situation, and how they're going to make their lives a little bit better.
So suffering causes us, we hope, to grow and learn.
Yeah, I think of it as heat treating. I think that in order to be really wise, people have to have experienced a lot and have to make it through a lot of tough times in order to earn their wisdom, or at least they have to in my stories.
Mm-hmm. And you serve up a lot of tough times. I'm going to say that right now. But, the human heart, I mean, isn't our heart always in some kind of conflict with itself anyway? And then that spills out into the relationships with the people around us?
Yeah, that's what Faulkner said about how literature works is, it's the human heart in conflict with itself. Mm-hmm. And so whatever else is going on in the outside world, the real tough business that the protagonist of a story has to deal with is within himself or herself.
So many of the stories, not all, but a number of the stories in Mothers Tell Your Daughters get right to the heart of that mother-daughter relationship, which can be so complex. And I remember mine with my mother. You want to hug her and feel like you're five again. And then a moment later, you want to push her away because you're trying to be yourself and you don't want to be like her. And that just seems to bounce around in such a strong way through these stories.
Yeah, and as people grow older, then it continues to change so that in a number of the stories, the daughter is middle-aged and then the mother is aging. And so that takes us around another turn.
Yes, it does. Well, with that in mind, I'd love if you could read from the title story, Mothers Tell Your Daughters, and read us a little bit of that. Will you set up what's going on, what's happening in the story?
Yeah, this is, as you said, the title story, Mothers Tell Your Daughters, and it was the last story I wrote for this collection in hopes of bringing together some of the themes. And what was really challenging about it was knowing I wanted a mother to be giving a kind of monologue to her middle-aged daughter. I had to construct it in such a way that she actually could give this monologue, and I chose to do it by having the mother unable to speak so that the monologue takes place in her head. She's a person who has always made sense of her life verbally and has maybe bullied the people around her into going along by having the last word. And so now she's unable to speak, but her personality is so forceful and powerful that she continues inside her own head. She's so certain that she will be heard if she just keeps on telling this story in her head.
And her daughter's there with her, right?
Yeah, her daughter is there with her and just kind of plumping her pillows and going through her drawers and doing things a daughter might do while the mother is silent in her bed. Ooh. But we're hearing this forceful voice all the while.
Great. Well, if you could read us a passage.
This spring after you were born, when I had no choice but to go out and plow, that's when I tied you in your crib by a wrist and an ankle. It was to keep you safe, not to make a prisoner like your daddy told you. Since you were my first, I didn't know yet how children could take care of themselves. My own ma didn't teach me what to do with something so helpless as you seemed. She fed me from a bottle, so I figured out breastfeeding from our milk cow, and each time I turned the tractor so this old two-story house came into view, my breasts ached. One time when I was out there, a tornado turned our big wooden barn into a dance of planks and loose hay. As I watched and prayed, strands of my own hair whipped my face. Now I'd give anything to be in that field, the wind in my face, looking at this house from the outside again. The doctor said for me to let you cry when I first brought you home from the hospital, but I couldn't stand knowing I was the only answer to all your troubles. When you gazed up at me in them days, I never had the luxury of looking back at you. I had to keep my eyes on the horizon to watch out for what was coming next. You complain about the way I raised you children, but I only wanted to survive another day. You see me as powerful in my crimes, but I was bone tired. Yes, I raised my babies, but today I'd crawl on hands and knees away from the responsibility of them needful creatures. Your brothers bring my great-grandkids to my bedside, and I close my eyes.
That is Michigan writer Bonnie Jo Campbell reading from the title story of her new collection of short stories, Mothers Tell Your Daughters. And it was, Bonnie, it was challenging to read your stories where a mother really isn't all that jazzed up about being a mother or a grandmother. And yet in another story, you've got a mother pouring so much love onto her kids, they tell her, in essence, back off, Ma, too much. You know, can we love too much, do you think?
Oh, well, just the idea that we have to get it right is too much to even contemplate.
True.
How on earth? You know, and often it's not a matter of how much love, but it's just how it comes out. You know, mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to make any relationship between any two people, if they're friends or a romantic pair or any two people in a family. It's a miracle if we can get along and really embrace each other and enrich each other's lives.
Yeah, and we really do see that through these 16 stories, people kind of pushing and pulling and kind of, it's messy. It's messy. It's human life.
And in truth, there's a lot of couples, like my husband and I, get along very well, but we're not very interesting to write about or read about.
Wouldn't be doing short stories on that. That's true.
No.
You actually draw very heavily on the incredible array of things that you've done in your life. One of my favorite stories in your new book is The Greatest Show on Earth, What There Was, 1982. And it's about a young girl named Buckeye. She's with the circus and has some tough choices to make. And as I read it, I found myself wondering, how does this woman who grew up on a Kalamazoo farm describe this circus life so well? And then I read on you and I discovered you were in the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I used to run away all the time. I was kind of a poor kid growing up, and I always had a conviction. I'm going to have adventures. I don't care if I don't have any money. So I hitchhiked out west and ended up in Phoenix, Arizona, where the circus happened to be in town. And I just got an idea and wandered up, and sure enough, they gave me a job. At first, they wanted me to sell cotton candy because that's what the girls did. But then when I proved to them how big and strong I was, they let me sell snow cones.
And I know your character, Buckeye, sells the cotton candy. And you do give us a real sense of what life is like day to day for those circus workers, right? What the rest of us have no idea about.
Yeah. Well, when I traveled, I was between semesters at college when I was hanging with The Greatest Show on Earth. But I was really surprised how the circus train itself sort of represented society in a way. You know, at one end of the train were the big stars. The head person had his own train car and a nice room and, you know, a living room and separate bedrooms and bathrooms. And then down at our end of the car, we were really roughing it with a lot of people shoved into little tiny spaces.
Oh, it just, yeah, the sense of place that you give in that, it is exquisite, that story. And you didn't just say, I want to be a writer, so off I go. I mean, it just staggers the mind how much you've done. From selling snow cones at the circus, you were a candidate for a PhD in mathematics. You are a second-degree black belt, I understand?
Yep, in kabuto, which is the Okinawan's weapons arts.
Yes, so you're about as tough to label as any of your characters.
Well, I always had this idea that I had to take every opportunity, and in fact, it was my mother who kind of told me, you really got to take opportunities, kiddo. And I have always done that. Whenever something interesting raised its head, I followed it. And I've had to do a little less of that now because I have so many nice opportunities. And it also turns out that writing takes an awful lot of time, many, many hours. And, you know, I'm a person who spends years working on a single story.
Really?
Yeah, in my last collection, there was a story I actually worked on for 24 years. And in this collection, I think it's about 19 years is the farthest back that one of the stories goes. So I'm kind of pokey.
Well, it takes what it takes, I suppose. And it also teaches all of us that the patience has to be there to be able to do the job right.
Yeah, it was a real revelation for me when I learned that writing didn't really require one to be brilliant. It just required a lot of hard work. And that's nice because here in Michigan, we know how to work hard. Brilliance we can't rely on, but hard work, we can handle that.
When did writing start to draw you in, Bonnie?
I've always liked writing since I was in high school, but I kept giving it up because it seemed that it was too competitive. I never wanted to be involved in anything competitive where you had to fight your way up. And so that's why I studied mathematics, I guess. but the call of writing kept coming back. And every time I really got serious about doing something else, I found myself running away and spending time writing. I had gotten my master's degree and I was working on my PhD, and my mathematics advisor, he thought I was spending an awful lot of time writing rather than doing math. And he suggested I take a writing course. That was about almost 20 years ago. And so I took a writing class and I said goodbye to the math degree. And I haven't looked back.
What was it about writing? What do you get from it?
Well, I get all that wonderful time alone to contemplate the world and life. And I do start all of my stories from real life. Not all writers do, but I usually start from a place where I'm worried about some real life situation, some person, or something I've heard about in the news that just grabs hold of me and won't let me go. And I am a big worrier. And so that's usually where it starts, my just not being able to let go of an interesting person in a tough situation. But over the long process of writing a story, I usually write that original character and write out of the story and end up with something else.
You let the story lead you.
Yeah. What I find is that these two things, the plot and the character, work together, and one has to accommodate the other repeatedly. So back and forth, make the story a little hotter, and that requires me to change the character a little bit. So I make the character a little more interesting, and that requires me to change the story. So I just inch my way forward.
Which is more challenging for you, the short story, the novel, and you write poetry? Which of those three is probably the toughest nut to crack?
Boy, oh boy, I guess it's the novel. I say that because I'm working on one right now. Because it incorporates so much of what goes into the short story, but it also requires a lot of architecture to be laid on top of what's going on. I can be very interested in a girl who loves mathematics, This is my new novel. A 10-year-old girl who loves mathematics, but even while I'm writing about her fascination with the Pythagorean theorem, I have to be thinking about how everything she's doing about her relationship with her grandmother and her sister and how she's doing her math in her book, how that relates to the book as a whole, which is going to be about 300 pages. Every single sentence in a novel has to be related to the whole book. It's impossible. Nobody should do it. But thank goodness they do.
Well, thank goodness you do. It's interesting. You mentioned you didn't want to think of the competitive side of writing, but you have won a lot of awards and nominations here in Michigan and nationally. And I'm wondering, did the attention and the awards and praise, has that changed the way you think of writing or the way you write?
It hasn't changed the writing process, except once in a while, it'll give me a little tiny boost of confidence when I think I can't do it. I can't do this story. I can't make it. I'm not smart enough to figure out how to write this story. Sometimes having gotten accolades gives me that little nudge to say, yep, you can probably do it. You can probably do it. Or if anybody can do it, you can do it. And that's about as far as it takes me. The nice thing is about writing is that even if there is a kind of a competition, I realize you don't have to ever think about it. You get to just sit in your office in your chair and write.
And send it out to the world.
Yeah. Or in the case of this book, for some reason, the whole time I was working on this book as a book, I was in my kitchen. I couldn't write in my office. So there I was in my kitchen with all my dirty dishes, standing or sitting at the kitchen table with surrounded by my home canned tomatoes and my pots of whatever I was cooking. So that was kind of a mystery about this book.
But a lot of those stories, now that you say that, that kind of thing's going on. I mean, last night I was rereading one of the stories, and that's exactly what she was doing, was doing her tomatoes. And you're doing a lot about women and mothers and daughters. So maybe just you were drawn to that. That's kind of the heart of the home, isn't it? The kitchen.
Yeah, isn't it funny? Yeah, and so now that I'm working on something else, I'm back in my office, and I can't imagine standing in that kitchen writing, and yet it was the place I needed to be. So much about writing is mysterious.
You know, your Michigan roots are so evident in your stories and in your novels. What is that Michigan writer's voice, do you think?
Like all people of Michigan, I say, well, I don't have an accent. I don't have any particular voice. This is how normal people talk. This is how normal people live. It's a fun project to think about what is peculiarly Michigan. And in regards to the writing, I guess I would say that Michigan folks are a little more geared towards survival than other people in the country, than people from other places. And it's not that we necessarily have it any tougher, but there's something about being here on our peninsula that makes us feel a little bit alone. Nobody has to come here who doesn't want to Michigan. You know, we're out of the way pretty much for everybody, you know, everybody else in the country. But there's something about us. And I think we often are thinking about how we would do if we had to make it on our own in various ways. So maybe we just feel that society is a little bit tentative. Maybe there's some little bit of us that feels that way.
Bonnie Jo Campbell's latest book is a stunning and sometimes unsettling collection of short stories, Mothers Tell Your Daughters. Bonnie, it was fantastic to talk with you. I love the book and already looking forward to talking with you when your novel comes out.
Oh, thank you so much. It was so fun to be on the show.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts.